Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we've got common mistakes that football fans make.
Somebody is so staunch in a belief or support of a club that pretty much everything you say just falls on deaf ears. It's like Sisyphus pushing the stone up the hill.
Everton's chances of survival this season. Fulham are worse than them. Forest are worse than them. Wolves are worse than them. There are a lot of teams above them that are not very good. We open up the burn book, and at a certain point everyone decided when you drink a G&T you need to feel like you're drinking like the blood of a medieval virgin, and I don't need to feel that. While over on the paid side, we discuss a possible Mo Salah replacement for Liverpool.
He is a really, really good player. Is he going to be as good as Salah? Absolutely not. I don't think anybody in the world will be as good as Salah in that Salah role. It's not fair to say that he's going to replace him like for like, but could he be a really beneficial cog in the post-Salah era for Liverpool? I think he definitely could be, for the right price.
And our all-time favourite meals. That's all in this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for yet another double bill, whatever we call it. I don't know, man. Like, to be honest with you, these are bonus episodes, Pete. We shouldn't be here. It's international break. Nothing's happening. Why are we here? Out of the goodness of our hearts and because we get
paid. Should have my feet up right now watching whatever I wish to watch on Netflix. Actually, watching the last episode. There is. David Beckham documentary. The icon of a generation.
Is there anything you're learning from that documentary that you don't already know?
That I love David Beckham so much. Actually, there is. The one thing I actually learned.
Nothing.
No. The one thing I actually learned from that was that the evening before he got sent off kicking Diego Simeone was the evening he learned that Victoria was pregnant. I didn't actually know that. And I wasn't angry. I was just genuinely disappointed in myself that I didn't know that, because it seems like really
that bit of trivia.
Integral part to the Beckham story arc. And I didn't know it.
Does it? How do you think it changed his behavior? Do you think he wouldn't have kicked Diego Simeone if he didn't?
We don't know, but surely it plays on the mind a little bit. He's going to become a father for the first time. He's out of wedlock, living in shame.
living in sin.
Living in sin. with Victoria Spice. Adams. Yeah. And then he has to go and play a World Cup quarterfinal against Argentina with, you know, a lot of history between the two nations. It's not going to not have an effect on his overall mental state. So
it also,
you know,
should have been a red card.
Oh, absolutely. Diego Simeone said that. When I watched it back on that doc, it's so soft.
Yeah, but I get that you're not allowed to kick someone and it doesn't really matter how hard it is, but it's so little that now you imagine a referee, like, depending who did it, if a player they thought was dirty did it, it would be like straight red. But some soft English boy did it, that they'd be like, if like Trent Alexander-Arnold did it, they'd be like, oh, we didn't see that. Like that was surely an accident.
It's the same as those like little headbutts, you know, like the little lunges that make tiny contact that then get red, because technically you headbutted a player. So, you know,
when it was agreed that you're allowed to, if you put your forehead to someone's head and pushed with your neck, that was like allowed, but not an actual headbutt. Like that was so dumb.
As long as it wasn't any bunting.
Yeah, we can't have like any momentum. But I mean, look, to be honest with you, I'm so desperate for something to watch. I might actually watch the David Beckham documentary, not least because I was like, I saw the clip of him going through his wardrobe. And I was like, finally, something for me. I don't want to hear about the football. I was there for it. I remember it.
Also, the other best clip you might have seen on social media was when Victoria Beckham, who was obviously known by the nickname Posh Spice, tried to pass that she was working class.
Well, have she is kind that? Of working class.
Well, have you seen the clip?
You can, but isn't the, I have seen it, but isn't the, but you can, your family can like make money and you will still be, like, so for example, you can be working class and if you win the lottery, you remain working class. Like, that's not how class works. We're not in America. Class isn't all about money.
Yeah, but also, one, she was labelled Posh Bison, two, she got driven to school in the Rolls Royce. I agree. There is a departure between, there's a significant gap between working class and whatever financial state the Adams family was in.
Alan Sugar is working class. Alan Sugar's really wealthy, and he's working class.
Would you say, this is interesting, because it's kind of like, their model class, I think it was Jason Manford, the comedian, says that he's muddled class now, because he grew up working class, very working class. He's now very successful. So his kids are now like nowhere near working class because they've grown up.
Yeah, but his kids are middle class.
Very wealthy. So, but he still has all the credentials and the kind of approach to life of a working class person. So he's in
my mum's like that.
He's in this weird kind of like state of limbo where he exists in both, but also neither fully in either.
But the way class works here is you'd say, well, you're working class. Like my mum, for example, is like, I'm working class. My mum was also a teacher, which is like basically the most middle class job you can get. But my mum's a working class girl from like Merseyside. But yeah, I always felt as well that Posh Spice, like the nickname was much more about her attitude, right? Like she has like a snooty vibe.
Yeah, which, I really connect with,
because when I heard her speak in that clip, I was like, I don't think I've heard her speak for 20 years. And it was one of those things where I was
really interesting.
It's weird to think that you were famous independently as opposed to being, now you are kind of known as being David Beckham's wife.
Yeah.
Or like part of the part of like the Beckhams. Whereas back then it was like, no, she's in the Spice Girls. She's like a superstar.
She is also a world-renowned fashion designer as well, no? But
she's not really. She is a fashion designer, but she's not a fashion designer like, you know, fucking Tom Ford's a fashion designer.
Sure. Yeah, I agree there are levels, but she's closer to that than a lot of others.
Yeah. I mean I'm not doing it down at all. I know that she's like had this career in fashion and stuff. I just think that like if you were going to the Oscars and you're on the red carpet and someone says, "Who are you wearing?" you don't really want to say Victoria Beckham. You want to say someone else. It feels a little bit crap.
It feels more lightweight than like a Prada or a Versace.
Whereas if you were like, I'm wearing David Beckham on my face.
DBI wear.
I'm wearing David Beckham like hanging around my neck like a sloth. Yeah. okay, that's enough of that shit. Oh yeah, before we get started, I genuinely had to... It's a good thing I wrote this in the docs because I would have forgotten. Yeah, announcement, big announcement that I'm leaving Football Daily, Pete, as of the 31st of October. So when people hear this, it'll be like 8 days, 9 days away, something like that, 10 days. After 8 long years,
arduous
8 years of... unbridled success, I would say. 8 years of probably making the greatest individual contribution to the game since Johan Cruyff. You know, like, who else are we talking? Who's been as significant as me, do you think?
Well, like as in the pantheon of football and great.
I'm going to take this long pause as an indication that you're really struggling to come up with a name.
Somewhere in between George Best and David Healy for me. Personally.
Great. That's good. That's good.
Which is pretty good.
They're both professionals. Yeah.
Yeah. Formative.
Not had that impact. Yeah. Exactly. I would say I'm somewhere between Pele and
a fraud.
Other people who are on Football Daily. You know, I'm somewhere between Pele and like a football Twitter account is where I'd say I am. That guy who
like a Stan account.
When you turn 29, that's where I am. Yeah, so I don't know. It's obviously been a long time. Just moving on now. Like it's as people know, I've kind of been like developing a second career, I guess, and now that's going to be my first career. So it seems like a good time to take the leap. So if you're listening to this free episode and you're not a subscriber, now is your opportunity to subscribe if you want to hear more incredible, well-informed football opinions. Yeah. Good opportunity to do that. But shall we move on to our questions, because this week we're doing a little grab bag of questions, and the first one's coming in from Robert Turner, and he says, what's the most common mistake football fans make? And I was looking at this and I was like, the most common mistake is actually kind of difficult, you know, like I think there are a lot of background assumptions in football that don't really get questioned very much. So I was really intrigued to know where your mind went when you first read this question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also interested to know how you interpreted this, because I wasn't sure if it was like, if it was intended as like the mistakes football fans make when they're trying to analyze the game, or they're trying to form opinions, or that, or just stupid things that football fans do. And naturally, I kind of landed on the latter.
I think I went for the former.
Did you? Okay, so we're quite.
Yeah, I didn't say like being racist or something, you know.
Well, the main one I went for was allowing emotion to affect sound judgment.
Well, that's fine. I think that kind of goes for both.
Yeah. So the thing that I get most frustrated about when trying to have a conversation with people, either friends or just like random people about football, is when somebody is so staunch in a belief or support of a club that pretty much everything you say just falls on deaf ears. And it's like, it genuinely sucks the all desire for me to continue with the conversation, because it's like Sisyphus pushing the stone up the hill just for it to roll back down as soon as they come back with a rebuttal. Because no matter what you say, they're not going to cede. Even if like what you're saying is completely fair and everybody in the football world agrees, they're so staunch in their belief that they're just like, no, I disagree, because I'm a Liverpool fan and I hate everything about Man United or Everton. And
yeah,
this might sound a little bit biased, but for me, at least in my experience, the ones that I find worst are Liverpool fans, in terms of just how, obviously it's born out of a place of like passion and emotional connection to your club. And I get that. And I get that, you know, in the heat of the moment, you can say stupid things or like make stupid assumptions about football. But once it kind of dust settles a bit, not being able to separate your emotion from like sound reasoning enough, not to be able to suspend that for like enough of a moment just to get out and form some form of rational thought, is really, really difficult. And I find it most common in Liverpool fans, at least the ones I've met. Not all of them, some of them are fine, but there are a good amount of Liverpool fans that I met who will never say anything remotely like, not even positive, just like agreeable about something positive relating to like a rival club, or that slightly diminishes Liverpool.
I think that's quite common. I mean, like this week, obviously, like I don't think it's just Liverpool or even
I've not found
Liverpool to be the worst, but that's also partially because my club doesn't have a rivalry with Liverpool. So like I can kind of check out of that. But like, for example, this week I saw like Chelsea fan accounts like posting pictures of Mudryk and trying to take the piss out of like Martinelli. And I just thought, like, this is insane. Like, you don't actually need to pretend that Martinelli's crap. I don't pretend that Reece James is crap, because it's silly. Like, there's no need to do that at all. Yeah, so I do kind of agree with that. I mean, and to be honest, like it annoys me probably the most in my own fan base. It annoys me the most with Arsenal fans, but I don't want to say that, because then people are like, yeah, Arsenal fans are the worst. And I'm like, I don't actually think Arsenal fans really are the worst. I think they're as bad as United, Chelsea, Liverpool. I'd say that City fans maybe annoy me the most, because I think that they are the most like thin-skinned about stuff that they could just agree with you on. They could just say, yeah, we know that like our success has been funded in like an entirely dishonorable way. They could just say that and say, but you know, I've supported the club my whole life and I still cheer when they score a goal. You know, I don't think that that's like an unreasonable position to take. Newcastle fans have started to get the same about this, but I find that the most annoying person is whoever you argued with most recently. Like to me, there is definitely, I've got a similar one in that I think there is like a kind of cognitive bias question, which is like, I think a lot of people say why in football, but they rarely do it honestly. So I hear people say a lot, why can't corner takers beat the first man? Why is that player shooting all the time? Why does the keeper keep playing out for the back when it's not working? Why doesn't he just kick it long? And I think if you actually think about it for a second and you ask that question seriously, like seriously ask why, you might arrive at some interesting conclusions. Whereas what you really say when you ask why like that is, this person's an idiot, I know better.
Yeah.
Like, why can't he just figure out what I know to be true? Well, normally, because there's another good reason that you're closing your eyes to. You know, so Arsenal fans at the moment are complaining about Odegaard shooting a lot. They're like, why is he shooting so much? He's shooting so much more than he did last season. Why is he doing it? Why is Arteta letting him do it? Well, if you think about it for a second, and you think about the kind of guy Mikel Arteta is, you realise that he's probably told him to do it. If you ask, like, why is a keeper continuing to play out from the back instead of kicking it long after a couple of mistakes? Because that's what the manager's told him to do. Yeah. And on the corner thing, why can't corner takers beat the first man? Well, if you think about it for a minute, in my opinion, the best corner, the most dangerous corner, is the corner that goes very flat and hard over the head of the first defender. That's the most dangerous corner. And actually, corners are not a big goal-scoring opportunity. They're like a 2 or 3% chance of scoring a goal. Mm. So if you hit the first man, doesn't really matter that much. Your 2% becomes zero. But if you just get it over the head of the first man, your 2% might become like 8% or something, which is a pretty big increase. Like, so I just think, well, it's because they're trying to do something that's very hard to execute. And sometimes it doesn't come off. It's not that anybody can loop across into the box. But how many of us can hit it really, really hard just over the head of the first defender? Almost none of us. And even professional players, not all the time. I don't understand it. Ask seriously.
If you loop that corner in every time, then the question will stop being, why can't you beat the first man? And it'll be like, why are your corners constantly collected by the keeper?
Sure. So, exactly.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Oh, that's a bad corner because it's gone too far. That's a bad corner because it's too high. That's a bad corner because it's hit the first man. Well, what's a good corner? It's either a corner that is like actually a well-taken corner, or it's a corner that somebody is so good in the air, they make it look good. But anyway, like my point is just ask the question seriously. If you really don't know why something is happening on the pitch, rather than assuming that it's happening because everybody involved is not as clever as you, maybe assume for a minute that there is a good reason. So in the same way, a lot of ex-pundits could ask themselves, I can see that zonal marking is crap, and yet, every proper manager in the game uses zonal marking. That's weird. I wonder why that is. But Jermaine Genus or whoever doesn't think, actually, Pep Guardiola is better at this than me. He thinks, nah, silly. Not for me. And they don't look into it any further. And so they never learn anything. And if you have the attitude of thinking you know everything and you can't learn anything, you will never learn anything. And
that's a real Jamie O'Hara approach.
Oh, God, that guy's
Gabby Abong Lahore. There's loads of them. Ignorance is wild.
But then you're just like, that's another thing, a common mistake I think fans make. Listening to people whose experience is not relevant to the modern game. Like, if somebody played the game 20 years ago, even if they played it about 15 years ago, I really don't think their experience is that relevant anymore. The game has changed a lot, and it's especially changed a lot since about 2011. Like, really rapidly. Since Pep left Barcelona...
15 years ago was like, what, 2008?
It's gone berserk. Yeah. Football was, like, completely different back then. Completely different. Formations were different. Tactics were different. Like, teams didn't press him remotely the same way. Like, we didn't have any of the metrics we have now to kind of... to work out what teams are doing. Teams played with wingers. A lot of teams didn't play with number 10. When Arsene Wenger started playing the 4-2-3-1, people were like, what is this? Yeah. Now the 4-2-3-1 is kind of an old-fashioned formation. Like, I mean, there's stuff like this where I just think, don't listen to people telling you about the game. Not least because, one, they always end up focusing on incidents. They always end up saying, oh, he should do better with this chance. Bullshit. That's rarely the case. Like, or, oh, should this be a penalty? Shouldn't it be a penalty? That's not a red card. You know, the game's gone. That would have been a yellow 20 years ago. Ignore all that shit. Stop focusing on incidents as well. Don't focus on incidents. What football is, the bigger question, which team is forcing the game into the shape they want the game to take? Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to win. But when you're watching the game, if like Man City are playing a match and that match is really, really up and down, then you know that the other team have got the upper hand because Man City don't want games to be up and down. In the old days, when you were watching a Wenger team, if you saw Arsene Wenger's team playing it in a U, you know, right back to the centre-back, centre-back to left-back, and then back again, like just round and round and round like this, you knew that that was not good, that was not what Wenger wanted to happen. He wanted it to be more fluid than that. Look at those things and say, which team... what is this team trying to do in this game? And what does the game look like? And that will give you a better understanding of what's going on than, was that a penalty? Was that a free kick? I don't think that should be a yellow card. Blah, 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 blah. Like, those things do matter. Of course they matter. But that's not really the game, and it's not really predictive of future success. Like, next time, is that going to happen? Probably not. So I think there's a lot of stuff like that. I don't know. I mean, I could probably go forever on this. Like, what else do you have?
The other one I have is, again, a bit more left field, but getting attached to a lone player. Never do it. Stupid mistake. And there's obvious reasons for this.
Who did you get attached to?
I know, I never did, but I've seen people get attached to lone players before. So obvious reasons for not doing it, because there's a pretty clear expiry date. And I think you can love them, but don't get anything that lasts with them. So, like, people who get the names on the back of a shirt of a lone player, weird. There was a person I used to work with who started a podcast with a pun of the name Udi Nagalo. It was a Manchester United podcast. And I didn't say anything, but I was like, well, that's got a shelf life, because in a year's time, the name of that podcast will not make sense, because Udi Nagalo will not be a Manchester United player. And yeah, it's just not a good idea. Side one as well. This one is kind of similar to this, but more general. Don't get a lone player's name on your back. But also, if you're over the age of 15, don't get anybody's name on your back. It's weird.
I'll go further than that. Don't ever wear a football shirt under any circumstances.
I mean, I'm
the only time you're allowed to wear them is if it's like kind of one of the fashion ones. So, for example, there are about 5 different Japan national team shirts that I kind of want.
Are nice. Yeah.
But every time I come close to buying one, I'm like, why would I wear this man-made fabric? And where would I wear it? Like, I'm not going to wear it out with my friends. I'm not going to wear it around the house. I'm not going to wear it to work. I mean, this week would have been a good week to wear it, because it's potty training week, so I've been pissed on constantly. That's a great time to wear a football shirt, because they dry really, really quickly, and I wouldn't care about it. But like, now you can wear you're allowed to wear a football shirt to a football match. It's fine. It's just that, like, I just look at it and I think, get a grip. Don't get a football tattoo, ever.
Oh, 1 second, someone's at my door. One second.
Unbelievable. Should I just carry on talking during this section? For anyone listening, while we record the podcast, I can see behind Pete's head a signed David Beckham shirt. It's just a matter of time until I see, like, David Beckham's head in a jar. We'll see if that makes it in. See what a careful editor Pete is.
Next door, just
hey, Pete!
What happened there?
Nothing at all. Yeah, don't get a football tattoo. Don't do it.
I mean, a football tattoo is pretty strong. What, like an MUFC and a badge or something?
Anything.
Old.
Anything.
Old. I mean,
don't ever do it. There's nothing that you can get that is good.
Yeah, I know. I fully agree with that. I probably slightly disagree with the football tops. I don't mind the tops. But when I see a 40-year-old man with, like, Garnacho on his back, I'm thinking, this is just a bit of an odd look.
That's an 18-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, and you're that wearing, is really
you're
weird.
Wearing his name on your back. I can make my peace with, like, the OG one, so a mid-90s Fiorentina with, like, Batistuta on the back. I can make my peace with that, because they're nice kits. And maybe it's because I was a kid when Batistuta was playing. Maybe that's what makes it more acceptable. But still, weird. Don't fall in love with
that. I don't know.
I mean,
at least there's an aesthetic appeal to, like, those shirts. Like, as in, you like those shirts kind of for aesthetic reasons, as opposed to I just have to have this season's shirt and a current player on it, which is kind of what I'm saying with the Japan kit. Like, I think it's understandable if you look at it and you're like, you actually think it's beautiful, because that's how we choose clothes. Like, I like the look of it. Yeah, I don't know. I just think that there are so many things. I think people acting like being tough is part of the sport. You know, when people kind of, like, Roy Keane loves to do this. He loves to imply that, like, only he and people he knows are, like, tough enough for the sport. Oh, you shouldn't be distracted by other things going on in your life. You should focus on the sport.
I hate that, yeah.
No, it's a game. It's literally a game. It doesn't matter at all. Nothing matters.
It's their job.
None of this matters.
They're getting paid to be there.
Yeah. Like, honestly, like, it's football. It's a little game for children that we have decided to pump billions of pounds into for reasons passing understanding. It's just a thing we enjoy. That's okay. We're allowed to just enjoy stuff, but it's not more legit. Like, if you're a 40-year-old man and you've got Garnacho on the back of your shirt, you're considered more respectable as a man than, like, a man going to, like, a Taylor Swift concert wearing a shirt that says, like, number one Swiftie on it or whatever. Why? Taylor Swift has at least made art. Art is more art has a more lasting legacy than Alejandro Garnacho, who's done literally nothing. All he's done is play for one of the worst Man United teams in living memory. Congratulations. Like, it's just stuff like that where I don't know.
The stray bullets United are catching here is wild.
I find all that stuff wearying, but like, oh, the table doesn't lie. That's another mistake. People assuming that the table basically shakes out to what it deserves to be. Bullshit. Table lies all the time. Luck doesn't shake out over the course. People used to say when a team got a bad decision, oh, well, they all even out over the course of a season. No, they don't. The season's only 38 games. That's not many games.
Yeah.
You can easily have like a bad run of games for like 10 matches and be fucked.
To find your season. Like, yeah.
That happens. It happened to Leicester last year. Like, it happens all the time. But the one positive thing I'd like to end this with is that we can actually get past these sometimes. So when I started at FD, firstly, no one even thought about key passes, assists, blah, blah, blah. They just thought about goals. But also back then, it was considered weird and very risky to focus on signing young players. That was something that like Borussia Dortmund did. And then when RB Leipzig came up, they started doing it. But actually other teams didn't really do it. And it was considered to be like strange. And the most valuable players were like 28-year-olds with big names.
This was what, like 2017? You
know, like 2015. Like round there.
You started in 2017. Yeah, 2015.
Yeah, like round there. So back then it was still kind of thought, you can get a 21-year-old for like kind of nothing. And a 28-year-old like that, because they're experienced. It's the most important thing. Well, look at this last summer. You're seeing people like Moises Caicedo go for ungodly fees. And yeah, he's going to Chelsea, who don't really care. But young players, Romeo Lavia, like these guys are now going for a lot of money because they've got potential and because they've got years ahead of them, which makes them more valuable. So that is kind of an argument that we won. Like we used to make that argument that it was better to sign young players, and football has changed. And now that is the case. So the analytics guys and the scouting guys, and to be honest with you, like the German clubs, like especially Dortmund and Leipzig, they really won that. So that's one as well. I think that's an interesting thing. That's an interesting example of a mistake people used to make that has now been corrected, I guess. Sorry, some fucker was idling his engine for like the duration of that outside.
I did hear that, yeah.
Yeah, like some virgin outside. Okay, should we move on to Matthew Coddington's question? And he says, what do Everton have to do to be safe this season? Which is kind of an interesting way of phrasing the question.
I think so.
Well, it kind of implies Everton are in danger. And my argument is I don't know that they really are.
I can see that, but they just about stayed up last year. They were 2 points ahead of Leicester, and both of the teams won on the last day, but Leicester had a better goal difference. So if Bournemouth had scored one goal against Everton on the last day and finished 1-0, Everton would be down.
Sure, but last year's Leicester is better than like five Premier League teams this year.
Yeah, but that also doesn't always matter, because sometimes you get, like you said, you get bad runs of games. And
yeah, but then we're just saying, like, what do they have to do to be safe? They have to not get unlucky. You can get unlucky and you're still probably better than three teams in this league, because the league is tragic. It's terrible. There are so many teams in the league who don't deserve to be here. It's unhinged.
I get why you're... Well, you're saying that you don't think Everton are necessarily in trouble, and I mostly agree with that, but there are certain red flags that I see that they could easily find themselves in trouble.
Okay, go ahead. Okay, I want to hear your red flags.
So the biggest thing at the minute is that they cannot score goals. That
is admittedly a problem.
They are actually pretty decent. If you looked at all of their numbers, apart from goal scored or the final score of their matches they've played, you would look at them and you would say, this is probably a mid-table team. This is a team that will be sitting somewhere in the middle of the table, be pretty comfortable, wouldn't really be that scared of relegation outside of some freak accident or some freak stretch of games that completely destroyed their season.
Yeah, they're ninth by expected goals in the league. They're sixth by expected goals against. Their expected goals difference is better than Tottenham's.
They're seventh by expected points. By expected points, they're above Brighton and Villa. Brighton and Villa are fifth and sixth, respectively, in real life. a lot of their underlying numbers are very, very positive and indicate that they should be much, much higher than they are, or at least that they shouldn't really struggle to hit like a 40-point mark to stay up. But last season, they had the largest disparity between non-penalty expected goals and actual goals. They scored 13 goals less than they should have, worst in the league. Again, so far this season, 8 games in, they are worst in the league again. Most wasteful team, scoring 6 goals less than they should have.
Well, sure, but I mean, like, they've changed striker in that time. Like, do we just assume that that's like, it's like a thing to do with Everton?
It's a 46 game sample size. Which
no,
is,
it isn't.
Yeah, it is. It's a full season.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't.
You're saying it's a 38 and an 8.
Because I'm saying that you're saying that this 8 indicates that they're maybe likely to do the same as they did in the 38. Like, you're saying this thing is going to be like that thing. Those are two different things. Like, the 38, I don't disagree with. I think if you change striker, it would be very strange if you saw exactly the same kind of underperformance. Like, that is just not generally how it works, right? That would be fantastically unlikely. Unless you're doing something very weird in the tactics that we can't see. And that's not our experience of Sean Dyche. In fact, Burnley, generally speaking, scored more than expected, especially in the Championship.
I'm not always convinced. I don't know. It's like it's a worrying trend, at least. Even though they've changed striker, it's a worrying trend that has existed and continuing with this Everton side. That when we spoke probably mid-season last year, or kind of towards the end of last season, we both said that like Leicester should be fine. Everton should be fine. And Bournemouth were definitely down. And then Bournemouth came out and were clutch and got loads of really big results against teams that they were directly competing with to stay up. Everton were lucky to stay up. Leicester went down. And I don't think a huge amount has changed in terms of their ability to score when they need to score. If you look at their games they've had this season, Opta have said that only 2 of their 8 games have been hard in terms of Opta's definition. 3 games have been easy and the other 3 have been just average games. They've lost to what? They drew to Sheffield, Sheffield's only point. They lost at home to Luton. They lost to who else?
Arsenal. They lost to Arsenal at home.
I mean, that's fine.
But they beat Brentford away.
They've got 2 wins in 8. So this is why everything's so weird, because it should be far more stable than this based on the numbers that their underlying numbers. But yeah, where is it here? They lost to Fulham, Wolves and Luton all at home. Those are bad losses for a team that was just about staying up last season. Fulham, relegation candidates. Luton, relegation candidates for sure. Drew against Sheffield, they're currently bottom of the league. My concern is that if you don't pick up points against the teams that are below you, you're going to find yourself in trouble. Because I don't see this team being good enough to be...
That's not true if there are 3 teams below you. If you don't pick up points against the teams below you, but there are at least 3 teams below you, then you don't get relegated. I agree.
Yeah.
Everton have been on a cold streak, okay, at both attack and defence. 9 goals from 15 XG, 12 goals against from 10 XG. This is poor stuff. However, there are still 5 teams below them. And of those 5 teams, only 1, Brentford, do I think is actually likely to be better than Everton. And above them, Fulham are worse than them. Forest are worse than them. Wolves are worse than them. Like, there are a lot of teams above them that are not very good. And so can they be better than the 4 teams they're currently better than? Yes. I mean, Sheffield United are terrible. Sheffield United just literally look like they're not equipped to play the Premier League. Burnley, kind of ditto. Luton Town, kind of ditto. Bournemouth, I still have faith. I think they hired a good manager. I think they bought some really good, interesting young players. But good, interesting young players are not necessarily like, you know, keep you up in the Premier League quality players. Fulham, crap. I think they're lucky to be where they are. I think they've been dreadful so far. Forest, I think, have been way better this season than they were last season, but have still been worse than Everton. You know, at both ends of the pitch, considerably. So...
Yeah,
you know, they've scored 1 goal fewer than Everton and conceded 1 goal more, but they have 4 more points. Like, it's kind of ridiculous stuff. Like, so I don't know. I just look at this and I think it's not perfect. I don't think they're as good as the numbers make out, because they've spent about 10% of the time in front. And as we talked about in the Liverpool episode, your numbers get beefed. You know, they're taking 15 shots a game. Their strikers are taking 4 shots a game. This is not going to continue. They're allowing 11 shots against, which is the third lowest behind Arsenal and City. That's probably not going to continue. They have the highest shot quality in the league. That's probably not going to continue. However, Sean Dyche is doing kind of interesting stuff with them. They're not actually playing like his Burnley side at all. They're very active defensively. They're not playing a particularly deep block. You know, Michael Cayley was talking about this the other day. He said, often, if you look at who's making the tackles in the middle third, that tells you how a team's playing. So if a team's strikers are making the tackles in the middle third, that team's playing a deep block. If their defenders are making tackles in the middle third, that team's playing a high line. Well, in Everton's case, the midfielders are making tackles in the middle third. So they're just playing like a normal line, like they're not playing particularly deep. They're also sixth bottom for clearances. So it's not like they're like soaking up pressure. The teams who have had fewer clearances than them this season are Brighton, Newcastle, Villa, Arsenal and City. So that shows you the kind of team that they're keeping company with there. If you look at their zones of control, which you can see on the analyst, Opta's the analyst website, it's 50-50. It's like they control the ball up to the halfway line and their opponents control the other half. So it's like completely 50-50. And actually, you know, they're pressing really high. They're fifth in the league for high turnovers. They're winning the ball high up the pitch. Now, again, probably partially a factor of spending so much time behind. But if their numbers could get worse and they could still get better just by virtue of their numbers kind of their play regressing to the numbers they're putting up. Do you know what I'm saying? So right now, they're like a plus 0.56 XG per 90 side. Well, that could halve. But if they stop getting bad luck, that they'll be a lot better, you know? So I just look at the league and I'm like, Wolves, I think, have like played some interesting games. But Wolves' numbers are worse than them. Luton are worse than them. Burnley, Bournemouth, Fulham, Sheffield United, all worse than them. Teams like Palace and stuff, debatable. Teams like Manchester United, minnows like Manchester United, probably worse than them. Like, there's genuinely a lot to like.
So many teams have far worse numbers than them. Like, they've got the second highest non-penalty expected goals in the league. Only Spurs have more non-penalty expected goals than them this season.
Sure, sure.
And Everton are what, 16th? It is a bit mental. And I mean, so the disparity between what is expected to happen versus what has actually happened, you would argue that it would be a safe argument to say that that's not sustainable. Like, it would be an all-time unfortunate season if this continues long enough for them to be like, shit, we're actually going to go down. And, you know, there are other positives obviously they've changed their forwards, but four of their forwards are in the top 25 for the Premier League for expected goals per 90. Dominic Calvert-Lewin is fourth, with 0.86 expected goals per 90, which is beefy, but caveat to that is he's only played 260 minutes. He's played less than 390s. So I'm positive that he will score enough goals for them based on what they're creating, even though the game state that they're putting themselves in, they've gone behind in 6 of the 8 games they've played. They've chased the game. They're beefing their XG numbers. I'm confident that Calvert-Lewin is a good enough player to score enough goals, or at least more goals than 4 teams at least in the league, for them to stay up, to get enough points.
Or somebody is. Some combination is. Like, it doesn't have to be Calvert-Lewin. Like, Beto's numbers are perfectly good for a mid-table striker. So all they need is enough output from those guys. And when Doucouré kind of plays this weird, I'm a midfielder, but I'm also a 10, but I'm also a second striker kind of role, I think they look dangerous. Like, they say to Onana, kill everything that comes at the defence. They say to Doucouré, just run up the field and support the striker. And it's honestly, like, pretty successful. And yeah, if Calvert-Lewin gets fit, I think that they'll be really fine. But I think even if Calvert-Lewin has like another injury hit season, I think between him, Beto and Danjuma, they should have enough to get it done.
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, yes, I agree that they should. My concern, my biggest concern is that their schedule is going to get hard. They have some tough runs coming up. They've had an easier opening run of fixtures than most of the teams around them. Like, if we're in this instance, I'm discussing them as a genuine relegation candidate. So the people direct the teams directly competing with them for survival have had harder runs and maybe have slightly less points, but they're not really that far back. In the next 11 fixtures, 7 of those include Liverpool, Brighton, United, Newcastle, Chelsea, Spurs, and City, most of which at home. So one, the next 11 games, 7 of them are very, very tough. Most of them are at home. So then that means in the back half of next season, a lot of those tough games will be away in crunch time. There is a 7-game stretch between February and March in 2024 where they'll face Spurs, City, Brighton, United, and Liverpool in 7 games. So if that's 5 of those teams in 7 games with City, Brighton, and United away. My concern is that for those big stretches of fixture lists, they could be doing well to get 1 point a game on average. So sure. These easier stretches, they absolutely desperately need to rack up points because there are
still ahead of teams below them. Those teams are going to play the same teams as they are, and those teams are already doing worse than Everton, who are getting unlucky.
I mean, they're doing worse than them, but they're what, 2 points, maybe maximum 3 points behind, bar Sheffield, who have 1 point. I'm concerned,
but like they're also worse. Like if you're behind and you're also worse, that's not a good position.
But
to
they're coming into easier, particularly this next say 7-8 games, are coming into easier stretches where they can basically all Everton need to do is beat the teams below them. That's literally it. That's all Bournemouth did. That's all Bournemouth stayed up. When it came down to the 6-pointers, when you play Fulham, beat Fulham. They didn't do that. When you play Sheffield, beat Sheffield. They didn't do that. It's not a major concern. It's just those are the games you need to win if you're going to stay up. Obviously, they're better, so they're more likely to get more results off mid-table clubs because realistically, underlying numbers suggest, and just general squad depth, they're a mid-table club. Everton are just a mid-table Premier League club. There's no real question about that, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But you still need to win those games. If you're giving points to the chasing pack, you're not helping yourself. You're not going to end up in a good position. It's going to be a dogfight at the end. And I don't think Everton...
I think we agree.
Yeah, we do. We do. We do.
We basically agree, which is like...
I'm just being more pessimistic about it.
Sure. Like, we're agreeing that like they don't need to like change formation. They don't need to do anything radical. What they need to do is start actually picking up the points that their underlying performances suggest they should be getting. That's all they need to do. And they probably need to... I mean, maybe you could argue that they could conserve themselves for certain fixtures. You know, like maybe when you go away, if say you've got Spurs at home and then you've got like City away, like maybe conserve your players for the Spurs game, not the City game. Like I know Spurs are top of the league, but come on, there are things City might be wise to do, but it's fine. So I don't know. I'm quite bullish on Everton. I think they'll be fine. If I were to create a middle class in the Premier League, they'd be in it. There wouldn't be many teams in it, but they would be in it. So I think right now they're kind of okay. And I guess we'll see, but they definitely do need to, you know, find their shooting boots.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that, but my mind is cast back to last season where we were both like, Leicester will definitely stay up. Bournemouth are dead in the water. They are down.
Yeah.
And, you know, it didn't work out that way, did it? So
yeah, but I do.
But
think
we are much
like,
earlier in the season,
and also last season it was like the league was tougher. Two good teams went down last season. Fulham got lucky all year.
Bournemouth took like massive scalps. Like they got like 6 points from two games that nobody expected them to get anything from.
They almost beat Arsenal as well. Like they
threw everything out of whack, and then Leicester were just shit.
Yeah, Phil Billing just went like Super Saiyan like for like 6 weeks. So I don't know, like it's always possible, but I just think for Everton to go down, they'd have to continue to play way below their level. The other teams below them would have to get lucky and get better. It just requires a lot.
If Everton continue doing everything exactly the same as they're doing now, I don't believe they'll be in a scrap for relegation. I believe they'll be easily 5 points safe by the time it comes to like the business end of the season. Just by not changing anything, because your fortune
United are worse.
Well, like we are shit. Everton are fine. Everything looks decent. It's just that they've been very, very unfortunate, and it's only 8 games. Like you can have a stretch of games where you just come up against a hot keeper, which they have done. Like what Leno had a fantastic game against him, and there are a couple others where they definitely should have scored more than they had, and then or your striker just misses a big chance and it changes the complexion of the game. Like, so many things have happened. They've just been unfortunate. I know we've said that a 38-game sample size isn't big enough, that the table will never lie, but I'm pretty confident that they've got enough, if they continue playing the way they've played, that they'll hit like 45 points easily and be fairly comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, of those two wins that you said they've got, like, those were in the last three games. And of the nine goals they've scored, seven have been in the last three games.
Yeah.
Like, so they have, like, it's possible that they are going to come into form. And, like, that Brentford game away, they were just the better side. And going away to Brentford and being the better side is no joke. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm positive, but we'll see. Let's move on to the burn book. All right, burn book time. Pete, what should we start with? Are we starting with what's going in? Let's start with what's going in.
What's going in?
I'm going to go straight in with this. Fancy glasses. I don't need my coffee in a tumbler. I got my coffee. I went out for a coffee yesterday and I got it in a glass tumbler, like one you would get in like a school canteen.
Yeah.
Don't need it. I don't need my G&T in one of those like goblets. Fuck off with this.
I hate that.
It's so stupid. I'm standing there holding it like I've fucking won the Triwizard tournament. I'm just like, can this like get out of my hands? It's embarrassing. And also, and it's got even worse since they got rid of straws. Because now I'm like, I'm holding this enormous goblet of ice, basically. And I can't drink out of it elegantly. And I look like a twat because it's colossal. It's like the America's Cup.
Soggy little cardboard straw in it.
Oh, God. Yeah, it's just... So I'm like, what? There was a time when you would order a G&T and you'd just get it in like a glass, just a regular glass.
Yeah, you have to request that.
I don't even know how to describe the glass. You know, like the glass that you'd get, kind of like the type of pint glass you get at a little niche brewery.
Yeah, like you know a Belgian, what I mean? It's like a Belgian beer that's like 12% comes in these glasses, really.
Like no, you're thinking of the ones that have like a little stalk at the bottom. I'm thinking of ones that are kind of like faceted glasses. Okay.
Are we talking about the gin balls?
No. I'm saying that you used to... No, I'm saying you used to get... Yeah, that is what I'm saying I don't like. But you used to get a G&T in like just a regular...
Yeah, just
a regular glass like you might get... Like you might get a Coke in. And at a certain point, everyone decided, no, when you drink a G&T, you need to feel like you're drinking like the blood of a medieval virgin. And I don't need to feel that. I need to feel like I've chosen the replacement level drink and I've got it in a replacement level glass.
I really share, and I'm not sure if this is coming across, just how much I share the hatred of the goblet, the gin goblet.
Stupid. Fucking stupid.
It's so dumb. But you can just request, when you order a drink, just say, can I get a gin and tonic and can I have it in normal glass, please?
Yes. However, I always forget that. Because it's like, even after a decade plus of this behavior that has gone unchecked in our society, it still doesn't enter my mind that the world has become so stupid that that's what I'm going to get my G&T in. And then suddenly someone hands it to me and I'm like, what is that?
Fuck.
Have I won a goldfish? Like, why are you giving this to me? Like,
it ruins it. It ruins a drink.
Am I getting my first communion? Why is this happening? So it's so stupid. It ruins the drink. I feel conspicuous the whole time. It's also a really top-heavy glass, which, like, I don't understand why you do that. Like, because it's so big, the bowl.
There's also so much condensation. Because they put so much ice in it.
Yes.
There's so much condensation on the outside of it that you're, like, you're essentially kind of cupping it to hold it, but then your hand is just drenched.
Yes.
And freezing.
You either drink it so slowly as well that by the end it's basically water, or you drink it so quickly because you want to get rid of the shame of your enormous glass that it's not pleasant at all. And you get a G&T because you're ordering in a hurry and you can't really think of something you want. Like, that's normally how you get, unless they have an amazing gin that you want to try. Half the time when you get a G&T, you're just like, I don't care.
It's always a 6 out of 10.
Yes, exactly. It's a safe choice. So sometimes I'm just like, you know, if someone's like, I'm going to the bar, what do you want? And you've got a second to decide, then your choices are basically get me something that's on tap that you know they'll have, or get me a G&T. That's what I say.
Also, We have a couple of the goblets in our house because I don't know if Jess prefers them, but she definitely uses them. And
well, she shouldn't.
I totally agree.
Have a
word. They take up so much space in cupboards because there is no way other than hanging them by the stem, which we're not a fucking professional barber. We do not have that facility. Putting them in a cupboard, there is no way to efficiently store them because they take up so much space. The top of them takes up so much space. The bottom of them is tiny. They don't tessellate well, so there's so much unused space that they're taking up by not actually... They're not actually taking up, but they're taking up just by being there. And it's just such a fucking waste of time.
That's a great point. It's a great point. It's like somebody being on the tube, like, with an umbrella up or something. Yeah. Everyone would be like, how the fuck... How do we make sense of this? Like, yeah, you're completely right. I really hate it when I'm trying... We also have some massive wine glasses, you know, that are kind of very similar to the G&T goblet. And I hate them because I'm just like... I never need a wine glass this big. I've actually got quite a lot of affection for the small wine glass. Mm. I never need a wine glass this big. And it sometimes I'm like, why isn't the cupboard closing? And it's because this fucking wine glass has just somehow migrated from the back of the cupboard to the front of the cupboard. And now I can't shut it anymore. It's bullshit.
Yeah.
Stop it.
I will admit, I do like a big red wine glass.
Nah, man.
I am partial to a big red wine glass.
I understand that they might be nice to drink from, to but they breathe. Are not so nice the wine that they're worth having in your house. They're not worth having in your house.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel that the wine develops better in a larger glass. I feel the gin is worse. Mm. And
sure.
Ultimately...
It is worse.
I don't want an experience with a goblet of gin at any point in my life. Put it in a heavy bottom tumbler, like a respectable adult.
Yes. The absolute worst, like... case that I want to encounter is a highball glass. I will accept a highball glass if it's all you've got, but I don't want it. Give me a normal tumbler for a normal man who just wants to drink a G&T without like rinsing my moustache in like ice water. Why would I want to do that? Stupid. I hate it. And the number of times that I've been somewhere and they've like handed that to me and I've just looked at it like, oh, sorry, I forgot to spell out to you that I didn't want to have to do this with my evening. It just pisses me off. I don't know why it's become the norm, but it's bullshit. Yeah. And similarly, I don't want a coffee cup without a handle. Give me a coffee cup with a handle. And don't give me one of those handles where, like, a normal person can't fit a finger through it. You know, sometimes there's a little handle.
Like with the espresso ones where you have to pinch.
Oh, God. I'm just like, an espresso, I'm completely fine with it having no handle. Okay. That's fine. I'm drinking that espresso... down in two or three minimum, like maximum rather. It's just going down the hatch. That's what it's there for. And I don't sit there holding it. Just give me a normal coffee cup. I don't want a little glass beaker for it. It's fucking stupid.
It is a very pretentious move. It's a very pretentious coffee move.
And they do it in shit places now. Like they do it in places where I'm just like, what are you doing? You know, even places
your
like
your coffee is not good enough for this level of arrogance.
Yes. I'm just like, okay, one time Emma and I went to this like very fancy chocolate place in Kyoto when we were in Japan, and they did hot chocolates and they came in little handleless stoneware cups. And I was like, that's fine because everything was beautifully designed and
they've earned the right.
You know, the whole place was beautiful and harmonious. It's not a fucking Cafe Nero, you know, where you're giving me like, I don't know, some deformed martini glass so that I can drink a macchiato out of it. Like, no, just give me a cup, you weirdo. Give me a paper cup. It's embarrassing. Anyway, sorry. Please, please, please come in.
Oh, no, please go. This is, I'm loving sitting here watching you get more and more irate.
Infuriating. It's just stupid.
Inefficient glassware.
It ruins my experience. If I'm paying like £4 for a coffee, which is already outrageous.
Yeah, mental.
Because I know how much the ingredients cost. If I'm paying like £4 for a coffee and then my enjoyment of that coffee is impaired by it being in a little glass that's burning my hands, or a glass that's just like kind of weird and not right, or doesn't sit in the coaster properly, and so like, you know, it's just like jiggling about, any of that shit, then I'm just like, well, I've spent like £4 to be annoyed. And with a G&T, I'm like, I've spent £10 to be annoyed. This sucks.
Yeah. Oh,
I could get annoyed for free.
I wish people, I mean, you are currently.
Am I?
I wish people could see this. Right. Yes, yeah, most definitely. Right.
Okay.
What I'm putting in the burn book this week are people playing loud music in their car or unnecessarily loud music in their car. So there's been a couple of instances in the past couple of weeks where I've been like walking down the street, and you know when you're walking down the street and there's like maybe a bit of traffic that stopped, and then you just hear that like distorted thumping,
yeah,
not too far in the distance, and you're like, where's that coming from? And as you get closer to whatever car it is, you figure out that it's this person with their windows fully up, blasting out some whatever like horrific drum and bass at an ungodly level. And then you look in the window and you see them like sitting there on their own in traffic as if it's like completely normal. They're emotionless, as anybody is sitting in traffic. And I was just thinking, like, what possesses you to do that? Well, actually, this is twofold. I believe I know what possesses them to do it. What would possess you to do that? To sit blasting music, even if it was good music or music that you like, the music is fine, blasting it at that level with your windows up for just you in the car. How is that a pleasurable experience? You could turn that down by 70% and it'd still probably be considered a little bit loud. But you would also still be able to hear the music. You would be able to enjoy the music as well as you would, probably more so, than the level you're currently playing at. But my working theory is that the people who do this, and this is where my main problem comes from, the people who do this in their own heads, I believe they think they are the coolest people on the planet. Yes. And that everybody around
them, that's definitely true.
Walking past are thinking, oh my goodness, that guy in that car blasting that music, he's so cool. I want to be him.
So
that's what they believe in their heads.
No, but I disagree with that part.
And the arrogance that they carry from that is why they're blasting their music, when in actual fact, it's the exact opposite in real life. Everybody walking past is thinking, this person is an absolute idiot. And that is my main problem. Somebody who thinks they are undeniably cool, but is actually quite tragic. That is my problem. Misplaced arrogance, we'll say,
I guess,
by the medium
of
loud music in a car.
I think of it differently. I don't think they necessarily are thinking, wow, everyone thinks I'm cool. I think what they're trying to signal is that they don't care and they think that is cool. So, for example, I think it's the same mindset as somebody who like throws litter out of their car window, which I've seen someone do probably once a year over the last few years. And I was like, that's crazy. Like, you don't really tend to see like blatant littering at this point. And objectively, it doesn't matter like what a hard ass you are. No one wants to live in an area where all the pavements are covered in litter. Like, no one actually wants that. So why are you doing it? Like, what are you signaling when you do it? Well, what you're signaling is, I don't care. I don't care about what everybody thinks is good behavior. I don't care that I could, you know, get in trouble for this. I don't give a shit because I'm too important and too cool to care. Of course, you end up making yourself look like a 14-year-old, you know, where you're just like, I'm so rebellious. Like, look what I've done. I've just dropped my crisp packet out the window. You're not a hard bastard. You're an idiot. But I think that's to me what it is. It's like, I don't even care. Like, I have my music as loud as I want. I don't care that it disturbs people. I don't care that it's bad for my hearing. I just don't care. And I think it's like performative, like lack of care, which people think is inherently tough and cool.
Yeah, I think.
I don't think other people think they're cool. I think they want other people. I think they're kind of amused by other people being annoyed by it.
I think we're like 80% in agreement there. I don't think people, when I said it, they think they're the coolest people in the world. I don't think it's necessarily a conscious thought, but they feel that they're being cool by doing it. Perhaps, again, rooted in the rebellious nature of what they're doing. Sure, I can believe that. I don't believe that they're consciously being like, I'm going to turn this up because it makes me look cool. But I do feel it's rooted in their subconscious, and that is a kind of underlying reason why they're doing it. But the actual result in the real world is the exact opposite, which they don't understand. Like, I still feel
that
they fail to see that that's how they're perceived.
Like, I'm winning this social interaction because my music is really loud and everyone has to hear it, and that means that I'm the coolest person here because, like, I'm kind of the king of this traffic jam. And everybody else is thinking, this person's a fucking dimwit.
Yeah.
And they're always listening to the shittest music you've ever heard.
It's just such a weird concept, and it always annoys me when somebody like is convinced that they are one thing or some amazing version of themselves, and then the reality is that society views them with the exact opposite view they have of themselves. Yeah, yeah. But they are completely blissfully ignorant to it and behave accordingly, and you're like, mate, wind your neck in.
On that point, the tube girl thing.
The tube girl?
Like that whole tube... Do you not know about this?
What?
I don't even know if I can explain this to you. Yeah, like this one girl in London like started this trend, right? Where she's like kind of like dancing on the tube and like lip syncing. And she's like waving her camera around like an absolute bell end. And it's provoked this craze. And it's like 99% women doing it. And there's been this weird attempt to kind of turn it into empowerment. Like, oh, you know, we're like not caring what people think and what people think, and we're like taking up space in public and blah, blah, blah. But actually what it is just like being a massive fucking twat, like thinking that you're being really cool when you're being so cringy and obnoxious. It's embarrassing. And I saw like two videos of this, and I told Emma about it, and she was like, I literally can't watch it. I know that it will kill me to watch it. And I said, oh, it's so much worse than you think. And afterwards, I was like, I am radicalized. Like, I need to go away and study the blade, because I am so, this makes me so angry. Like, I just couldn't. Yeah, it's the same thing. I was just like, you're not being empowered. You're not being cool or fun. You're just being fucking obnoxious. You're being fucking obnoxious. Stop it. Like, take that shit back to the New York subway.
I don't know if this is the same thing, but it sounds kind of similar. But basically, all the freshers have descended on London in the recent months, recent weeks, I suppose. And Jess was on her way back, and she was on the tube, and this group of freshers like were either doing some TikTok or trying to take a picture or a video, and one of them was like pushing Jess out of the way to make space for her to be in this video, and Jess was like, "What the fuck do you think you're doing?" But it sounds like the same concept that people are just it's not cool, it's just rude.
Yeah, you're like,
and
I'm a real adult. You're not. Like, you're 18, not an adult. Sorry. Like, you think you are. You're technically an adult in the eyes of the state, but are you a man or are you a woman at the age of 18? Are you fuck?
There's no such thing as an 18-year-old man.
Never happened.
Not that I'm overly fucking enlightened, no, but at 18 I was insufferable, as you can imagine.
I was the biggest twat on earth at 18, except for everyone else I knew. No, but seriously, I look back on stuff I did back then and I was like, I can't even make sense of it. I don't even know why I did that stuff. Like, it was ridiculous, but I just think about the way that, you know, people who are 18 will say, I'm not a child, and you think, no, but you are though.
Yeah, absolutely. You are.
But you know that you are, and the reason you're saying, you know who doesn't have to say, I'm not a child? A 40-year-old.
Somebody who's not a child.
They never say it to you. Yeah. Have you ever heard like your grandfather say, I'm not a child? No.
Yes, basically, if you have to say you're not something, you probably are it.
Yeah, exactly. So that one annoyed me. I mean, I think I'm just going to cheat this week and put in another thing because I'm so pissed off. I could put the tube girl thing in, but I was actually thinking this week how annoying it is that some people make hard work their personality and not
like
hard work.
Hustle culture. Hate it.
But it's not even just that. Like, there are a lot of people who would say they hate hustle culture, but every time you see them, they're like, oh my God, I'm just like working so hard. I'm crazy busy at the moment. You're like, what are you crazy busy with? And they're like, oh, work. And you're like, right. And what else? And they're like, oh no, just work. You're like, sorry, so you're crazy busy just with work? Because like, okay, I know that I'm like parent-pilled at this point or whatever, but to me, crazy busy is like, there are six things going on in your life, of which one is work. It's not just like, work is busy. That is something that happens to everyone sometimes. And I also think that a lot of people believe, they wouldn't say this consciously, but they believe that their jobs are unusually difficult and require unusual talent. And they believe that they themselves are unusually skilled and talented in order to do those jobs. And I actually think that's not true. I think 99% of jobs are, if not easy, they're at least straightforward. once you get to know how to do them. So for instance, like
the system.
Yeah. So like, you know, being a bin man, I don't think is an easy job, but it is straightforward. You know, there are lots of jobs like that where it's like, it's not easy. It's like tough work, but you know what you're meant to do and you just have to do it. Like there are things like that. But I think a load of people, and maybe this is just because I've been dealing with a lot of solicitors and stuff recently, they truly believe that their job is really, really complicated and that only they can do it. And it's just like not true. It's like most jobs, like after a couple of months, you could learn how to do it to a good standard. And sometimes I think the advantage of me doing a job for the last 8 years that didn't matter at all. And I mean that in the sense that like we were covering football and like football's like not an important thing.
It's like, not life or death.
I wasn't a fucking nurse for the last 8 years. Like the advantage of doing that is that I think I'm under no illusions about what my job means. I don't think that if I don't turn up to work at like X law firm where I work or X accountancy firm or whatever the fuck, that the world is going to fall apart.
Yeah, I know it won't.
Whereas sometimes people will talk to me about football and they'll be like, they'll be telling me how football doesn't matter, like to my face. They'll be telling me like basically how my job doesn't matter. And then I'll be like, what do you do? And they're like, I'm a management consultant. And I'm like, explain to me how that matters. Like, what is the difference? We're both parasites on a different industry. And I just think that when you do a job that doesn't like matter, as in make a difference in the world, it's actually quite helpful. Like, firstly, you separate your ideas of ambition from work, because often you hear people say they're ambitious and what they actually mean is, I want to get promoted at work, I want to earn more money. Well, there are loads of ways of being ambitious. You could be ambitious to be like the best father you could be. You could be ambitious to say, I want to, you know, record an EP with my friends. Like, I want to write a book one day. Like, those are also ambitions that have nothing to do with your ability to earn money. It's just about something you want to do for the sake of it. That's ambition. And so that's part of it. But also, I think I'm not under the illusion that I matter so much to my company, because some people as well talk about their companies as if I start early, if I finish late, if I'm always the first in the office, if I answer an email at the weekend, then my corporate dad, you know, like the company I work for, will love me more. And when the time comes, I will be rewarded in paradise for like what I've done. And actually, your boss doesn't care about you and will not care about you for a second longer than you are useful to them. So if you stopped being useful to your boss tomorrow, you would be out the door and they would have a job advert out instantaneously. Yeah. You don't matter to them. And that's actually okay. It's fine to say, I'm not selling you my every waking thought. I'm not selling you, you know, I'm not asking you for love, for you to tell me that I'm like a good boy and pat me on the head and tell me that my life is worth living. Like, we are trading something here. I'm trading my time and my labor for money. That's why I'm fucking here. That's why I'm fucking here. That's what the money's for. Like, nothing else. And so whenever I see people doing this, and I see it all the time, people will be like, oh, you know, just like, oh, my job is such a pain in the ass. And then it's just like, but they still are trapped in this mindset of like, but I still have to work super, super hard and get the approval of my boss and blah, blah, blah. No, you don't. Your boss can't sack you for doing your exact job and not anymore. That's not how it works. That goes to tribunal.
Yeah.
So I just think, let go of it. Let go of it and just accept that your worth as a person has nothing to do with your value to a company. And the fact that you work really, really hard at that job is not like really an important thing about you. Like, I don't look at my friends who work really hard at their jobs and like them more than my friends who don't work hard at their jobs. I don't give two shits. It has nothing to do with anything. It's just like how they are. That's fine. But yeah, I don't know. I just find this like absolutely bewildering. I think it's so weird, because also I think the generation below us are much smarter, or at least have come to the conclusion they're like, commuting is bullshit. Like, jobs are bullshit. We don't get paid enough. This sucks. We need better treatment. But at the same time, they fall into all these same traps because they're just like the way things are. Yeah. And I think it is worth thinking for a moment, like, when you think of yourself as ambitious, what do you mean? When you think, oh, well, I need to get a promotion to earn more money, why? What do you want more money for? if that that question, you know, that obnoxious people ask on dates, like, if you won the lottery tomorrow, like, what would you do? I think that's quite a good question to ask yourself, because you know what you probably wouldn't do? Eat shit from your boss so that he'd love you. You'd probably tell him to fuck off if he was taking the piss. And as somebody who has, like, a relatively abrasive manner sometimes at work, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If you do your work and you're fair and you apologize when you're a bit of a dick, it doesn't matter. But you don't need your work to love you, and if you want that, you'll never get it. It's a chimera. It's an impossible dream. Just give it up. Sorry. Carry on.
You know the way you have, like, live, laugh, love?
Mm-hmm.
Like placard boards in people's houses. There are a lot of quotes there that I'll need to go back through them, but give up your dreams will be one of them.
Give up your dreams.
It's an impossible dream. Yeah. It's an impossible dream. Give it up would probably be my takeaway from that.
Just give up on everything.
If we ever start selling merch, that will be one of the first, I assume.
Give up on
Patrick
your dreams.
it's an impossible dream. Give up.
Your boss hates you.
Your boss's approval means nothing. Really?
Yeah. But also, you know, next time you're trying to win the approval of your boss, and your, like, boss is telling you how, like, so-and-so, another person you work with, is such a useless dickhead, recognize that your boss has 100% said that about you sometime.
Said that about you behind your back.
And not when you deserved it. They did it because, like, you know, you forgot to attach a file to an email, and they're like, oh, yeah. God, what a stupid bastard he is, you know?
Yeah.
Fuck him.
Work so you can live. Don't live so you can work.
Yes. Yes. Work is not life. Pay, at the end of your...
If they didn't pay me, I really enjoy my job. We give Julia Fox a microwavable cottage pie today.
Really?
That was part of my job. That was part of my day. But if they didn't pay me to be there, I would not be there. Simple as that.
Of course. You're like, why would I choose to be here? Like, it's just not... Yeah. That's not the way labor works. And it's ridiculous for your company to essentially require that you pretend that you love being there. You don't owe them that. You don't owe them that at all. You already don't get paid for your commute. You spend an extra 2 hours a day getting to and from your job. Do they pay you for that? Do they fuck? Mm-hmm. They're pricks.
But they expect you to do it.
Exactly.
Written so in your contract that you do it.
Get fucked. It's bullshit. Yeah. It's bullshit. It's bullshit. It's bullshit.
Right. So we'll allow the double in from you, given your miserable week you've had so far. What I'm taking out of the burn book is a quick one, and one that you'll probably hate, but don't care. What I'm taking out of the burn book this week is the NHL season,
ice hockey
season.
I thought you were going to say the NHS. I was like, yeah, I'm fine with the NHS. I worked for the NHS.
Great.
So, no, I've always wanted to get into ice hockey, but back. I find it's silly. It's too silly.
So the NHL season's back. It started...
I can't see the puck. Where is it?
About a week ago. Well, it's on the ice. It moves fast, but it's there.
It moves so fast, bro.
Yeah, but then it slows down at parts. It's fine. Like you learn to live with that. You learn to be able to follow it. But it's back. Right. It returned about a week ago, just over a week ago. And for as long as the Premier League season is, the NHL season's fucking long. So it's pretty much like each team plays 82 games regular season.
God.
So like over 9 months, it's pretty much... There's a game every 2 to 3 nights. So it's fairly relentless. So once the season ends, I kind of just completely cut off from it and don't consume anything about it until the start of the next season, just for like to avoid burnout. But then that means every time it comes back, you're like, oh shit, this is sick. Like, I personally believe ice hockey is the best form of sport to watch. It is the most enjoyable form of sport to watch because it's fast paced. There's a lot of action. It's physical, but it also requires an immense amount of skill. And when they get pissed off, they can just fight.
Yeah. And like, also, it's like, it's very Canadian.
Oh, so which is by far the best version of America.
Yeah, exactly. That's like the upgraded America. Yeah, it's that's very much the kind of business class America, Canada. That does make it more fun, though. Like, if you turn on the ice hockey, there's always somebody who's like... It was like, oh, tonight it's the Maple Leafs versus Toronto, you know, like, blah, blah.
Going to be
and
a good game, like, oh, eh?
Yeah, and you're like, fuck yeah, this is great. This makes it...
Like a Terrence and Phillip have turned up.
Yeah, I'm going to see like two farmhands beat the shit out of each other, like completely forgetting about the puck.
I also love that, like, there are so many defined roles in a hockey team as well, because there's like, what, 22 players. 22 players.
Really?
Well, let me see, top six, 3 on 3, 20 players, including two keepers. So there's a lot of guys, but like
in
in the squad.
Okay. Yeah.
But some of those guys are literally like, they're just called enforcers. So like, they're not really good at anything. They're just big, and they just fucking hit people. Like, they just check people. They're just like absolute, like bull in a china shop. And then,
do they just have to stop calling them goons?
But they, essentially it's the same thing. It's enforcer. Yeah.
Well, they're like, oh, we can't say goon anymore. We'll say enforcer. Okay.
If they're on the ice when like one of your like Bukayo Saka takes a big check, you're just expected to fight the guy who checked him. That's just kind of
that sounds great.
Yeah, it's just fun, man. So yeah, love that it's back. Hopefully, you know, Calgary Flames do well this season. Somebody actually messaged you last year, the fact that I mentioned the Calgary Flames.
Yeah.
And Alberta in general. I looked it up. His name was Michael Girum. So big up to Michael Girum.
Why do you support them? Why do you support the Calgary Flames?
Basically, I really liked the Mighty Ducks when I was younger and enjoyed ice hockey. I had two friends who I played field hockey with at school, and they both had family in Calgary. So they supported the Calgary Flames. And I was like, this is the closest connection I will ever have to any ice hockey team in America or Canada. There is no better reason to start supporting them.
What's the Montreal team called?
The Canadiens. The Montreal Canadiens.
That's ironic. Yeah, the Canadiens. Yeah, that's true. That's ironic though, isn't it? Yeah. I'll support them.
The Montreal Canadiens.
I just want to go to Montreal. All right, yeah. Well, look, and I'm actually fine with ice hockey. Every time, when I was a kid and ice hockey would come, you know, like we'd go out and get drunk and then we'd come back to like a friend's house in the middle of the night and you'd just put on like whatever was on and you'd watch Premier League years or whatever. Like sometimes we'd watch ice hockey and I was always like, if I could see the puck, this would be great. But instead what would happen is every now and then, like someone would just score and everyone would go berserk. And I was like, oh, right, now I can see the puck because it's in the goal.
That was always the biggest problem, though, because obviously, like, Alberta is Western Conference. It's towards the west coast of the region.
Yeah.
But yeah, pretty much all the games start at, like 2 a.m., 3 a.m. So for years, you just had to, like, either not watch them or ruin your sleep schedule, whereas now there are services you can pay for that mean the games are on demand to watch at your leisure. So I can watch them. There's one tonight, midnight. I'll watch it tomorrow. But it feels that it's live.
Great.
It's kind of like as close as you can get. You're so unenthused by this.
I just can't get another sport into my life.
In the pandemic, I got into basketball as well, which is another 82-game season. So there was football, basketball, ice hockey, and it was just too much. It was just like, there was just something every single night.
There was not
an obligation, but there was like, oh yeah, that's there, I could watch that. And it became quite laborious. It was almost kind of like a bit of a chore. But yeah, ice hockey's the OG.
Okay, well, one day when my kids are like at university, that's when I can get into ice hockey. So just the 20 years from now, and then we'll be good. All right, that brings us to the end of our free episode. Obviously, if you listen to the free episodes but you don't subscribe, consider subscribing, because where are you going to get such depressing football content? Now that I'm leaving FD, you can always get Pete's depressing football content. You just got to tweet at him and ask him for it. But yeah, thank you very much for your support. Thanks for sending in your questions. Continue to get them in. We'll be back in a couple of weeks and we'll catch some of you over on the paid side. Bye-bye.